Welcome back to the show. Today we're going to be taking a little break from the conversations around collapse to talk about another important issue and I think, you know, tangentially related to the topic of collapse, and that's emotions, emotional clearing, emotional healing. My guest today is Dr. Douglas Tatarian. Doug has been a mentor and friend for many years, and he has, more than anybody else in my life, taught me about and given me the tools to really understand, work with, and release the emotional patterns and debris and gunk that tends to get stuck in my system. So I'm really excited to share this conversation with you, and I think it's really appropriate to follow the conversations that I've been having about collapse with the conversation on how to kind of be a good steward of your emotional system. I know for me, these conversations on collapse bring up a lot of stuff if I really take them seriously. Feelings of inadequacy, loneliness, insignificance. And if we want to become the kind of people who can really step up and step into our power and be of service in this time of transition, we need the kind of tools that Doug is teaching, period. I just can't imagine any other possibility. Like, we need to become skillful stewards of our emotional system. I believe that very deeply. And so really pleased to bring this conversation to you. I think you're really gonna enjoy it. And as we mentioned at the end of the show, Doug is going to be coming to the Monastic Academy June 21st to 23rd. He'll be leading a retreat, a bioemotive emotional release and meditation retreat. This will be a great opportunity, if you enjoy this conversation, to put these practices into practice and take them into your life, to really learn some tools that will serve you for as long as you use them. And so if you want to check that out, really hope that I see some listeners there. You can check out a link in the show notes to the Eventbrite page. The last thing I'll share is that this will be the last podcast for probably 2 or 3 weeks at least. I'm going to be taking a little break. First thing I'm doing is going to Costa Rica to join Joe Brewer, who's been on the show 3 times, to go to his workshop on managing planetary collapse. Really excited to go there. Part of the inspiration and reason for me to attend is that I'll be taking the course to bring back some gems in building a new curriculum here at the Monastic Academy, part of which will be covering the situation on the planet right now and trying to make sense of it and present it in a way that people here can understand and live their lives in response to. During this break, I'll also be feeling into, sensing into what the next step of this conversation is. You know, I think there's a lot of directions that we could go in now with this project, but I feel the need to kind of step back and step into some quietude and contemplation and reflection and really feel into what wants to emerge through this project and through my life in this project. And so, you know, this might be a good time to go back through the back catalog if you've only recently joined the conversation. But in any case, I wish you well in these couple of weeks of break, and I look forward to rejoining you soon. Okay, please enjoy this conversation with Douglas Tatarian. Welcome back to Emerge. Today on the show, I'm joined by my friend and mentor, Dr. Douglas Tatarian. And today we're going to have a conversation that I hope will be, you know, wide-ranging, but talking about emotions, human development, and the very fascinating work that Doug has been doing. I'll just say from the outset, before we kind of dive into the particulars, his work, his framing, and some of the practices that he teaches have been completely and totally transformative for me in my life.
And so it's really, I've learned a lot from Doug, and it's, this is a conversation I've been looking forward to for a long time to have on Emerge. And yeah, really, really pleased to have you on the show, Doug.
Well, and I'm flattered to have the relationship with you that I do have, Daniel, because I'm so aware of what you're bringing to the world and who you are and what you're becoming that, you know, I really honor and value the fact that we've had a chance to connect with each other. And even more so that you're saying I'm influencing you in a positive way.
Oh, it's undeniable. You know, I think we first met when I was working at Buddhist Geeks. You joined the Buddhist Geeks community, and you know, part of my role was sort of welcoming new members. And I remember we had just a pretty in-depth first encounter, like a one-on-one video call. And I remember you just presenced a lot of things around emotions that were just not a part of my contemplative or practice experience. And it's taken me a while to really, I think, kind of grok, or at least to the degree that I have, what you're bringing to the table. But it has made a significant difference to my life. You know, for me, when I first got into contemplative practice, there was no place for emotions. And you've really opened my eyes to how significant emotions and feelings are when it comes to our own development, our own growth. And I wonder, maybe a good place to kind of kick things off would be to just sort of like, if you were willing to, and you can kind of take this in whatever specific direction you want, but what do you see as the kind of, or how do you understand the role of feelings and emotions with in relationship to human development?
It would probably be easier if I said in relationship to meditation, and that would maybe set a little bit more of a background for me to explain things that I could then answer that question a little bit more closely or clearly. Because some of it, it's hard to really answer that question without giving some background constructs. I suppose I could try though. one of the things that when I got exposed to integral theory and spiral dynamics, I got quite taken by it. And I remember listening to an interview that Ken Wilber did with the Sounds True lady, Tammy Simon. And at the end of, I think, a 10 or 20 hours of her interviewing to get all of his material onto an audio for their system, their Sounds True platform, she asked this question, which was, so this is wonderful, all these five dimensions of Aqual. Can you give me the three-dimensional model? How do they all relate to each other? And Ken just sort of looked at her, I imagine looked at her, and said, there isn't any. Hmm. And I actually just remember really being like affected by that question. And I went, there's got to be. If he's actually pulling out some really underlying structures of reality, we know things aren't random. We know that there's underlying forms here. So I set myself off on trying to answer that question. And I came up with something I call EBIC integral. And I presented it at an integral conference in 2010, one of the integral theory conferences. And what it did was attempt to integrate an underlying structure that I brought to my clinical practice, which is the triune brain theory. So that's Paul McLean's work that he really did a great job bringing together the neuroanatomical evolutionary history of the primate brain, you know, right from, you know, a few million years ago, and saying we seem to have three different layers of brain structures. And this is something that, even if it's not true, it works really well metaphorically, because it's like physical, emotional, and intellectual. And those three categories show up in our culture in all sorts of different places. So I had been using that in my clinical practice, and often what I say is that your intellect seems to be in control, and the emotional system seems to be the dysfunctional younger brother that everybody's trying to hide. You know, and I started thinking about integral theory and stages of development from that perspective, And I came up with a fairly unique take on the stages, which basically says that those stages seem to reflect a progression of the sense of self through first the physical, then the emotional, and then the intellectual mm-hmm. brain. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've come to believe is that if you've got any leftover emotional impressions, if you've got sort of little traumas from your life that you haven't worked through, then you can be at a second tier layer level of development. But when you get emotionally activated, the brain structure from that time of the trauma will become dominant, and you'll regress down to a lower stage of development. So without going into a lot of detail, that's kind of the simple answer, that emotions and feelings are the things that bring us back down to our shadow elements or our lowest stages of development. And until we work out those shadow issues, we're going to keep falling back to those lower stages, even if we've got many other levels above that.
Nice. Yeah. And so maybe could you then talk a little bit about the relationship between this perspective and meditation in particular?
Well, I found, you know, with me being a householder as opposed to a monk, which is kind of something I contemplated early in life, and both my wife and I believed that we would go off to monasteries when we were both in our early 20s, and then we met each other and destroyed mm-hmm. that, and ended up becoming, you know, married and having four kids and really getting into the nitty-gritty of samsara, you know? And so because I'd had a very strong meditation practice when I was a teenager, like literally when I was 15, I was spending, you know, anywhere from 3 to 10 hours a day in meditation. I had a lot of insights and understandings about the nature of reality and who I was, but without any kind of context to interpret it. I had no teachers at that point, right? But it seemed to set me off in a certain direction. And now which meant that I was quite committed to that contemplative life, even in my everyday immersed life of, you know, relativity. So I started doing practices that I could do to keep that kind of contemplative part of me alive. And one of the most effective things that I found was this habit that I developed after I discovered it in my clinical practice, which was anytime I got emotionally activated, I would ask myself, what am I feeling? So if I left, if I saw a client and I kept ruminating about them, if I kept thinking about them after the session, I'd go, okay, there's something personally activated for me. And I'd core down to the, you know, what I have come to call the core feelings. And I'd remember my particular issues or traumas associated with what had been activated by my relationship with the client. I'd spend some time with it, and I'd often cry or share with my wife and be, you know, upset. And then in the process of that expression, I would find that it would get resolved. It would go away. Now, if you notice what I just shared about me leaving my clinical practice and finding myself ruminating about something, that has a direct implication for meditation. Because what's the first thing that happens when most people sit down to meditate? Right? They tend to start thinking about other things. They tend to start ruminating about something or another. And because I'd formed the habit of going after the emotional activation, I had a similar insight about what was going on with meditation. So when I went to Vermont and I went to do the retreat there, even though I hadn't had a regular meditation practice for some time other than a weekly sit that I did with my wife on Sundays, I dropped into some very deep states, much deeper than I was anticipating. And I think is usual for people who come from the outside to drop in so quickly, like I think within a day or two. And in retrospect, I realized it because I'd done all this emotional clearing. And so that's one of the things that I now highly recommend any meditator do. There's a sort of a fine line, but it needs to be defined where if you're sitting down to meditate, you're supposed to discipline your mind to go on the object of attention. And there will always be these kind of things that pull us away for a little while, but you come back. Now, if you find yourself constantly going to the same thing over and over and over, I found that it's probably not worth the energy of just using discipline to go back to the object of attention, to actually then make whatever you're being pulled to the object of meditation and ask yourself, what am I feeling that would be making me think about this situation? So it's not a deconstructive, like rational deconstruction of it. It's an emotionally or feeling-based deconstruction of the thing that's pulling you away. And usually what you'll find is that there's some emotional charge that you've been neglecting. And so if you go into that emotional charge, let yourself feel it. Often that, you know, as I've mentioned, involves crying. But then once you've acknowledged the feelings and cried about them, when you go and try and meditate again, you'll find that you're not being pulled over to that dimension of your life anymore, because you've essentially worked out the energetic charge.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And that's exactly what I've noticed in my practice since I've kind of used some of the frameworks you've offered me, is that so much of the time when I find it difficult to concentrate, it's because there's some kind of, like, the way I think of it is that there's like emotional energy that's infusing my thoughts, and my thoughts are kind of like feeding off of this emotional energy. And I try to go back to whatever the object of attention is, like my breath, but it's like there's too much energy pulling it away. And there's this kind of like compulsion. But then when I do the practices that you've talked to me about, like the releasing statements with the 9 core feelings, I'll release the energy, and then all of a sudden I can just like concentrate.
Suddenly your mind is free.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. And it's a totally different approach. It just makes meditation so much easier once you've added that little tool to your toolkit, right?
Yeah.
I actually did this as an experiment with the group that I was running with Darlene, maybe 5 or 6 years back, we did an integral meditation group. And at that time I was still like exploring this as a hypothesis. So I had everybody do a meditation, but to stop every 5 to 10 minutes and write down some of their mind chatter, just 2 or 3 instances of what they were thinking about. And then as a group, we all got together, people submitted their mind chatter to me anonymously, and I put it up on a spreadsheet. So there were like 10 to 12 pieces of mind chatter per person and about 8 people. And then as a group, we looked at each piece of mind chatter. So that was on the left, and across the top, we had the 9 core feelings. And we all went, okay, so if you were thinking about needing to pick up milk on the way home from work, right? What would you be feeling that would make you think about that? And people were pretty good at coming to a consensus that, you know, depending on the dynamics of the person, if they offered it, that might be coming from a feeling of inadequacy, that they're going to make another mistake, they're going to forget it, and then their spouse is going to get upset with them.
Right.
Right. And we found that everybody, and this was really interesting, when we went across all, you know, 12 to 15 pieces of mind chatter, they were all being generated by usually 2, maybe 3 core feelings. But then when we went to the next person, they had the same thing. It was 2 or 3 core feelings, but totally different core feelings. Right. And that just kind of really highlighted the fact that people tend to walk around with these unresolved feelings that show up in their life in different ways.
Yeah. 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 And so this has been for me, the most significant, thing that I've put into practice that I've learned from you is this, the releasing statements related to the 9 core feelings. And so first of all, I think it's useful to say, like, your position, what you've discovered is that these 9 core feelings, that's a complete list of the kind of feelings that a human can feel.
Yes. And it seems like we're biologically wired to parse these nine feeling dimensions out of our relationships because they're important for us to know in terms of our relational status to others, right? Like we need to know if we're significant or insignificant to our group. We need to know if we're valued or worthless to our group, because when crisis comes, we're going to behave and be treated very differently depending on what our actual relational status is to the other people around us. So I actually think that I've discovered, kind of like in the same way our eyes see the three primary colors, I think I've discovered these nine primary feeling dimensions that we're constantly extracting out of our relational environment to know where we stand in the world. And it gets complicated when we start changing relationships or groups and we keep old, often childhood-based feeling impressions in there, right? But that's a whole other story. I want to go back to the meditation, if that's okay, because I think there's a couple other pieces I'd like to clarify. I've actually come to see, you know, because I am now getting a bit more time to spend in meditation. I'm taking Chula Das's Mind Illuminated training now. And so we're working through some of the jhana states and some, you know, just sort of hanging out in the higher stages. And as I've come to see the meditation process, if you think about the physical brain, you hear something and it automatically creates an object out there, right? This is the constructive nature of reality. We're taking sensory inputs and creating an object. And then what I see is that the emotional brain adds some valence or tells us if that object is important. So if I've just created my living room in the physical brain, I'm going to see a computer. And that computer has a little bit more valence than the cardboard box on the ground. It has more importance. So my emotional brain takes the material that's being created by the physical brain, tells me what's important, and then guess what the intellect does? It thinks about what's important.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So now we think about the fact that we tend to live in our intellect and we ignore the other stuff and we sit down to meditate and I'm saying, okay, my breath is important. I'm gonna override all my other innate processing, you know, that's going on and make that the object of attention. But the emotional brain is going, what are you doing? You know, you're not the master here. I'm the one who says what's important. I want you to think about this stuff. Right? And so that's why going back down and clearing the debris from your field that says, and it's debris in the sense that it's just usually accidentally activated. So go spend some time with the accidentally activated emotional importance stuff. Process it and resolve it. And often you'll find yourself going back to deeper patterns, but you know, that's the same thing. You still just process and resolve it. If you're feeling insignificant or inadequate, you tune into it, you say the words, you find the emotional energy and you discharge it. And now you've cleared your emotional brain of that importance or that valencing that it's doing. And so it's much easier to put your attention on the, you know, breath or whatever it is that you're focusing on in meditation now. So it's almost like learning to live in harmony with your brain system instead of just doing a command brute force override of your brain system.
Which is what typically the prescription with meditation amounts to once we see
right.
with this model. Yeah.
And then the problem becomes that you're essentially, to the extent that the stuff isn't accidental activation, but chronically activated material about, you know, often associated with your sense of self, now you find yourself in a retreat setting, trying to relax and go deeper and deeper, but now your unresolved emotional stuff starts pushing harder to be experienced, right? And you get those kind of breakdowns that happen
yes.
in retreats.
Yes.
because you're not distracting yourself from that stuff anymore. You're sitting with what's arising, but what's arising is emotional and we don't know how to process it. It's just so much simpler if you know how to process it.
Yeah. And so I think one of the things that I most enjoy about this 9 core feelings framework and the releasing statements is like how simple it is. I've been sharing it with people occasionally, when it feels appropriate. And I did it with somebody recently and it brought them quickly to a point of crying, which we can talk about the significance of crying in relationship to this model. But afterwards they said, "This is so simple. I feel like it shouldn't work." Which for a while I felt that way too. I was like, okay, there's 9 core feelings. Interesting. But my emotional life is so much richer and so much vaster than these 9 feelings can really accommodate. And yet when I sit down and in the case of meditation, I can't focus, it's always one of these 9 core feelings that's activated, always. And then I process it, I release it, and then I can concentrate.
It's amazing, isn't it? The apparent complexity of our emotional system, I think, comes from all of the interpersonal feelings, because there's much more than 9 of them. Though I think if I sat down, I could parse them into groups. But there's, like feeling rejected, feeling dismissed, feeling like someone's arrogant and condescending and treating you like you're, insignificant. Like it's all the complicated interactions, because, two people in the same work environment being treated, the same way by an arrogant and dismissive boss, one person might have 1 core feeling being activated. Another person might have 3 core feelings being activated.
Yes.
So that accounts for the apparent, for the actual diversity of our emotional experiences when the same stimuli trigger different people very, very differently.
Yeah. Yeah. And so can you just unpack a little bit the difference between feelings and emotions? Because I think that's really central to all of this.
That's something that I actually often forget to talk about because it's so foundational to how I see the world. I forget that our culture still fuses those. We use them interchangeably. And in the odd theoretical framework that separates them, they still do them very differently than I do. So I'll explain how I define these terms. An emotion is something that dances in your body. You'll feel the energy dancing in your body. And as far as I can tell, there's only 4. We have anger and fear, and we have happy and sad. And once those emotions get triggered, we have what you would call fixed behavioral physiological responses to that. So we're genetically programmed to dump, certain chemicals into our system and do certain things in terms of, dilating the eyes, vasoconstriction of the hands, evacuating the bowels at the extreme, of it. For a fear response, it's slightly different for the anger response, but they're sort of what I guess the behaviorists would call fixed action patterns in a certain sense, but they're also internal. So once you stimulate an emotion, it's just going to happen. And it's pretty universal across, I would say, not just humans, but across animals as well, because animals have a mammalian brain. They have an emotional brain. That's why we bond with dogs, not reptiles, because reptiles basically just have a physical brain. So anything that's got an emotional brain is basically going to have those 4 emotions. The feeling part is where it gets a little bit more nuanced. And I think that I see a feeling as our emotional brain's best guess as to our relational status or the relational dynamic right now. So when I'm watching somebody treat me a certain way and they're looking away from me and they're looking at the ground and they won't make eye contact and stuff, I'm more likely to infer that he's feeling uncomfortable about something and maybe he's deceiving me because he won't look me in the eye. So I might get a feeling that he's untrustworthy. And it's happening from my emotional brain. All those nonverbal cues are being processed by my emotional brain, not my intellectual brain. You have to do explicit training to get your intellect to catch on to those things. And I'm doing that constantly and making assessments about my relational status to that person.
Yes. Yes.
Right. And that's why I can feel rejected by somebody, or I can feel dismissed by someone, and they may not actually be dismissing me because they got their own stuff going on, and maybe they're just hyper attentive to, you know, the fact that their life is falling apart and they need to attend to certain things, and they're not really looking at me in the same way that I'd like them to, not because they're dismissing me or that I'm insignificant or they're not trustworthy, but just because they're really preoccupied. Mm. And that's why it's always important when you have feelings to check them out with the other person. But that's a whole other dynamic. We're still going to take in the feeling impression of being dismissed or that they're not trustworthy. And then we have to deal with that.
Yeah.
Now, what I just described is an interpersonal feeling. So things like, and interpersonal means they happen between two people.
Yes.
So those are words like dismissed or rejected or abandoned, right? They need two people to really play their parts for that to happen. Interpersonal feelings cause core feelings. And the core feelings are those nine cores that I talked about. And everyone will react to interpersonal feelings slightly differently depending on the history that they have and the sensitivities they have. But in general, interpersonal feelings, which are my best guesses of the energetic dynamics between me and the person, will cause core feelings, which are often associated with my history and what I'm sensitized to. And then once an interpersonal feeling has caused a core feeling, it will elicit an emotion. Mm. And the strength of that emotion will depend on how big my kind of perception of the threat or impact of that relationship is.
Right. And so what I notice in practicing this is that, like, I wake up in the morning and I'm living in a monastery. So I wander downstairs at 4:30 in the morning and very tired. And I sit down. And one of the first things I do after I get a little bit of concentration is go through these nine core feelings. And what tends to happen is that, you know, there are three that are most typically activated for me, which are alone, inadequate, and worthless. And there'll be typically with them, but sometimes with others, some constellation of activation present. Just, I guess, like, it comes up like when I sleep. I'm not really sure, but I wake up and it's there. And then I do the releasing statement. So I say, I feel alone. And then what happens now in every instance is that I can bring my kind, and it feels like a physiological response. I bring myself to a point of crying, which I know is quite important in your system. And then after I cry, and usually I do this silently, you know, I can kind of just like sob silently. I return
sobbing silently.
Yeah. Well, you're in a meditation also, you don't want to.
You're so respectful.
I know. People. Yeah, it's a learned
don't
skill.
Don't mind me. I'm just sobbing in existential pain here.
It's a learned skill. It's something hard won. But then I return to my experience and I check again. I say, I feel alone. And there's just no response. There's no response from the body.
Yes.
And so can you talk a little bit about, like, I guess go into a little bit more detail about that process and why crying is so essential in this releasing practice?
Yeah. And it actually might give a hint for you to change your practice a little bit. Maybe we'll see as it comes, because as you do this, it should eventually go away so that it stops haunting you in the mornings. So when you're sleeping and, you know, this is the time so everything I'm speaking to you about is my observations kind of as a mystic and a clinician, right? And a lot of it is informed by research, but that's not something I get to do now. So I'm going to tell you how I see dreaming and sleeping, which is that when you go to sleep, you're basically turning off the intellect, which is dominant during the day, and you're moving first into a dream world. And the dream world is where your emotional brain becomes dominant. right? So when you're dreaming, you're basically giving your emotional brain the freedom to play out the dynamics that are important to it. Mm. And so when you wake up in the morning, you're likely, especially because you have so little stimulation in the monastery, you're likely going to be trying to play out and resolve long-standing issues mm-hmm. in your system. So that's likely why you wake up and those three feelings, core feelings, are all activated. So now when you sit there in the morning and you acknowledge those feelings and you turn them into tears, you're essentially taking this sort of deep, I won't call it abyss, but like say pocket of pain, and you're draining a little bit of it. And whatever kind of got activated by your dream sequencing. And then by crying and discharging it, you've kind of cleared what's leaked out of that pocket that mm-hmm. you're carrying. And now you're good again. It would probably be good for you to spend some time actually meditating on the aloneness and trying to get into that big pocket or reservoir of pain and explore your early, likely, you know, childhood or present dynamics to see if you're continuing to, because of my clinical practice, most of the work is about finding the initial childhood impressions. But on the other hand, you actually may be living in a monastery and experiencing on a day-to-day basis that you're not getting the kind of connection and relationship with people that you'd like. And so that you, on a day-to-day basis, you're feeling lonely. And what was the other ones? Inadequate and worthless?
Worthless. Although I feel those less here than I used to. But yeah, those are still the kind of typical, my standards.
Okay. So then I would just have you, you know, check into the loneliness and see if that's actually being continually stimulated by your environment. Because if it is, and you really are lonely, it's going to be hard to resolve that out of existence without actually doing some work on the vision you have for your life. Because that would imply that there's a discrepancy between where you are and how you want to be if it's being activated.
Right. Right. And can you just share a little bit about why crying is so significant in this releasing practice?
Because it's part of the emotional brain's natural healing sequence. For when you take in an emotional impression and you feel the pain of having been rejected and all alone and maybe insignificant, and you acknowledge that deeply, your emotional brain completes the wound, you know, completes the experience of that by crying. And I think that's part of our evolutionary history, where when we were hurt, we cried, and then those that loved us would come to us and nurture and hold us to make us feel connected and cared for, to make us feel significant, and update us that we're a valuable part of the group.
Right.
Right. So the crying is the unconscious communication, the nonverbal communication that we're in need of help from our family or from our group for it. And that, you know, so that could speak to the fact that you're crying alone and nobody's there holding you means you're not updating an impression of being, you know, loved and part of something at that level.
Yeah. And to be fair, like that was partly just an example for the sake of conversation. I use these practices now quite often, like in, we do a practice that, you know, of called circling here at the monastery. And so, I have many experiences of crying and being held by the community. And so, I think, so part of it, or a lot of it, I think is just my own, you know, early childhood stuff that it comes up, reconstellates itself given just going through life. You know, it seems like, and this is, what your approach has given me insight into is like, just going throughout your day, being a human, you accumulate small bits of, as you say, debris that if you don't release them, will build up into a dam, essentially, that really shuts us down from our ability to live our lives. But that by doing this practice on a regular basis, you know, I do it two or three times a day, it just releases it, and then nothing really gets stuck in a big way.
Beautiful. And, you know, I think what you're doing too is, as you continue opening your emotional system and doing these little clearings, it's going to be easier and easier for you to start, and maybe you do this already, but in general, it means that one of the aspirations of a meditative community is often to sort of walk around with their heart open. And that's what this allows us to do. Once you've cleared a lot of the historical stuff up, you can be in the present without this whole torrent of old pain trying to make it through. So we can actually start living in the moment in an open and vulnerable way with our emotional system fully present and fully taking in impressions. And it's a very different way of living for most people. Most of us are in the intellect, and often when we're in a Vipassana retreat, there's a stage where everything becomes very bright and luminous. And that's usually because we're finally getting out of the intellect and more into the experiential aspects of our being. And so we become more sensorially present and more emotionally present. That's sort of one of the goals of meditation. And that this practice certainly helps facilitate that.
Yeah. And so another kind of aspect of this practice that I'd love to hear you reflect on is the relationship between language and these core feelings. Like, it's so interesting. Like, I now, because I've done this practice enough, kind of can recognize, without using the phrase, like, when I'm feeling inadequate. And I can see it in my somatic experience. It's there. But then as soon as I say in my mind or out loud, I feel inadequate, something happens. It becomes intensified. Then I say it again, and the crying, the liberation process happens. And it's like, what is going on there? How is it that language has this power to release or activate, or however you want to frame it, these feelings?
Yeah. A couple dimensions going on. One of them is the act of naming a feeling begins to extract it from our experiential sense of self. So as soon as I say, I feel worthless, I'm no longer being worthlessness. I'm beginning to make my subject object. So it pulls the worthlessness out of my sense of self, makes it an object, and it's now something I can work with and process. So that's the disidentification component of naming the feelings. Do you know what I mean when I would say someone walking around being their worthlessness?
Totally. Yes.
And they can't name it. They just are it.
Yeah.
And they don't even know what it is they're playing out. But and that's why it's nice to have the 9 core feelings, to actually, when you say them and you don't know what energy you're stuck in, and then one of them starts to resonate, now you can start to objectify it and work with it.
Yeah.
The other reason I kind of really encourage people to say the words out loud is that most of us live in our intellect. I keep saying that. And there are actually repressive mechanisms between our intellect and our emotional brain, whether it's going through the hippocampus or whether it's going through the corpus callosum. There's research showing that emotionally laden words can't make it across the hemispheres as easily as neutral words. So by saying the word out loud, if you're just saying it intellectually, it's going to go into your ears. It'll be processed by the physical brain into the word construct, and then it will be heard by the emotional brain, and it will get a chance to own it and feel like, yes, that's what's going on with me. So you're literally training the emotional brain to recognize the energy state and giving it an opportunity to be heard and sort of experienced in reality, because we're living in the intellect, the emotional brain, like I said, is the it's often the little brother that's pushed aside all the time, the little sister that's pushed aside all the time. And by the intellect saying the word, the emotional brain begins to feel honored and allows itself to begin to express itself, because it's like you're literally giving permission for the emotional brain to take up some of your space.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating, because sometimes we'll like be sharing this practice or inviting somebody into this practice, and we'll say like, okay, so try saying, "I feel lost." And they'll be like, "I feel lost." And then their eyes will just, they look surprised, right? Because they had no idea that they were feeling lost. So they say it and their body is just telling them, yeah. And then they say it again, yeah. And again, you know, and it happens. But that initial moment, right, where they're just like completely taken by surprise. They're shocked that they felt that they feel lost.
In my deconstructive, you know, realm process, I'd say their intellect is shocked that their emotional brain is feeling lost. And the only way they're really understanding that the emotional brain is feeling lost is because the physical body is dancing to that energy. They're still not in touch with their emotional brain, but they're seeing the dance in the physical body, which means it must be true.
Yeah.
And as you do this work more and more, you'll actually begin inhabiting your emotional brain instead of just noticing its dance in the body, which is a secondary, you know, way of seeing the emotional brain.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. And so, you know, for listeners who are curious, as I hope you are at this point, I'll place a link just to the 9 core feelings. Like, this practice, again, is so simple. You just go through the list, say them out loud, see if there's resonance. And then I think of it as kind of like pulling on the handle until there is this kind of crying response, which I've also noticed that crying response is something that now is much more accessible to me. Like, when I first started getting into this, it was really hard for me to cry. And now I cry every day, and it's beautiful, and it's very accessible. And so that too is something that I think comes with this practice.
Yeah. And for people doing the practice, you said they say the words out loud and then their eyes well up. Sometimes that doesn't happen until they've said it out loud like two or three or four times.
Yeah.
And eventually, as you do this, you'll notice that as I put it, the brain that's moving the mouth will start to change. And the emotional brain will actually start saying the words, and you'll hear a difference in the timbre and the quality of how those words are being said.
Yeah.
And that's becoming now an expression of the emotional brain, which is where the real healing is taking place.
Yeah.
And the harmony and unification is happening at.
Nice. Yeah. And so I'll put a link to the show notes to those if you want to experiment with this practice. Cool. So now that we've sort of laid out this, these ideas around, you know, how the emotional system functions in the individual, I thought it would be fun to zoom out a bit and talk more about how this might be showing up in our culture. And I know that you, you and I have talked a lot about, you know, different developmental levels, like postmodern mind and things like that. I thought your analysis of the social justice warrior phenomenon would be a fascinating place to kind of break open this more cultural discussion of the role of emotions and feelings. Could you talk a little bit about how you see social justice warriorship from the perspective of your models and what you've learned?
Yeah, this is something that I've been trying to apply what I call my EBIC integral model to kind of the present day phenomena that we're seeing. And it's starting to give me some good insights into the dynamics that you don't really get when you deconstruct through other modalities. So in the EBIC integral, which, you know, EBIC stands for Evolving Brains in Quadrants, which is kind of my three-dimensional model of integral, traditional or amber or blue consciousness is the communal way of being, the value structure for what I would say it's the emotional brain's way of kind of domesticating itself. So in the way I've come to see the world, the first two stages of spiral dynamics integral, or spiral dynamics, the survival and the magical thinking, we're basically in the physical brain. And the qualities of those two have a lot to do with the qualities of the physical brain. When we move up into the kind of dominance hierarchy, warrior, might takes right kind, might makes right kind of thing, that's the emotional brain playing with the anger and fear responses. And it's very impulsive. The emotional brain is that, and you get angry and you hit things and it doesn't care. Mm. But the communal version of the emotional brain is where the happy, sad stuff is and where the bonding occurs. And it has to start playing out the relational dynamics of getting along with other people. Mm. And so there's this kind of mythological story that the emotional brain tells, that everybody has a role and there are rules to play by. And it's really not a fully differentiated sense of self, but it's beginning to allow lots of people to interact with each other by following these rules in the particular role that you're at. And it's the black and white thinking stuff. Now, the next two stages, which is modern and postmodern, are actually the intellect. So you break out of the mythology, the rules and roles that you've been raised in, when you begin thinking for yourself and discovering who you are and what you want to be. That thinking process is unique to modern. It's in terms of a dominant way of seeing the world. And then the postmodern comes about when you start thinking about thinking. And those three stages there, traditional, modern, and postmodern, seem to be where most of our culture is dispersed through. And so most of the conflict that we have going on in our cultures is because for the first time in history, we have these three different value systems all living in the same place. And they're so fundamental in how we see the world that it's very hard to communicate across them. There's very little common ground. Yeah. Now, traditionally, and when I say traditionally, like in terms of the conventional spiral dynamics, whether it's integral or Clara Graves, these are seen as progressions up a ladder. And while they're kind of like that historically, I don't think it's really like that for us as individuals. Mm-hmm. There's a huge environmental component to each of these worldviews and value systems. So in our culture, we've essentially created a postmodern environment. Mm-hmm. Which means we're very sensitive to individual differences. We honor them. And we're trying to make sure that everyone feels honored. And I'm going to maybe come back to that notion of feeling honored, because it really only happens in postmodernism. But we're now raising our kids in a postmodern environment. So their egos have to adapt to that environment, which means that the dance that they're doing to organize their ego structures is a postmodern dance. They have to have that sensitivity. They have to be aware of individual differences. They have to respect them. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they've gone through the developmental stages of breaking away from a mythological rule versus role-oriented way of living to find their own individuality and know who they are. So in a sense, their psyches or their way of being in the world is postmodern, but their developmental place inside in terms of their own individuality may still be very traditional, right? Because they're kind of following the rules and they want to be accepted. We find that traditional mindset very much in school. And without having done the work to find their own individuality and to be humbled by that process, I think what's going on with a lot of the social justice warriors is they're taking the sensitivities of the postmodern world, but they're reacting to them from more of a traditional developmental stage, which means that it's, you know, you're on my side or you're the enemy. There's this black and white thinking that goes there. And I think that's why the social justice warriors appear to be highly evolved, and yet at the same time are acting like children in terms of their inability to have that free speech and have a rational discourse, because developmentally, I don't think they've actually earned that capacity yet.
Yeah. And I find this analysis to be really clarifying when, and for me, I noticed that it kind of like sucks all of my emotional energy out of my relationship with social justice warrior, that like phenomenon, because I'm just like, oh, like there's developmental work that needs to be done. You know, this is coming out right. of a different mind that actually just needs to go through a natural developmental journey. And yet, I think in the absence of the kind of framework that you're offering and you know, just normal technologies and supportive structures for human development, that journey may not take place. And so you've also talked to me a little bit about like dysfunctional postmodernism versus functional postmodernism, and how your practices or kind of doing these sorts of releasing work might help create a more functional postmodernism. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I used to be upset that when I was looking at the triune brain, the physical, emotional, intellectual, I was upset that, like, if we're in the intellect, then why haven't we fully integrated and mastered the emotional brain? Why do I look around and see so much emotional dysfunction in our culture? And it took a few years to figure this out, but I essentially realized that it's not till postmodernism that feelings are honored. We learn about emotions in, you know, the sort of dominance hierarchy place, because that's where anger and fear show up. And we also get emotions acknowledged in traditional, because there is the bonding and the love and the closeness and the happiness and the sadness that's kind of there, even though they're pushed away. Basically, because in traditional consciousness, you're not an individual. You have to fulfill a role. And if you get too caught up in your personal emotions, you become dysfunctional. You can't fulfill your role. When I was growing up, which is still the last edge of traditional, my parents were very traditional. So was the culture. So I watched my mother have to fight and cry about wanting to get her driver's license because my dad was going, "Why do you need to drive? Everything you need is at home. I can bring anything you want," right? It was a very different world back there. And her crying was kind of seen as an inappropriate thing. She was supposed to just play her role, but she was basically pushing into modernism. I want to do this. But in pure traditional, emotions get in the way. So I also would hear about people who had mental breakdowns. And that meant that they were crying, sometimes for hours, sometimes for days. And you know what happened to them? The ambulance came and took them to the hospital just because they were crying. Now, when you're playing a role and you're not allowed to have emotions and they finally break through, it usually means you've been suppressing them so long that they've just completely overwhelmed you by the time they actually happen, which is why it's called a breakdown. You can't function anymore. So emotions get in the way of your role in traditional. And if they do come up, they're usually so big and overwhelming, you can't function. We move into modernity and emotions basically are there, but you choose not to get involved in them because they're getting in the way of your goals and aspirations and achievement. And
right.
Plus modernity is one of our individual stages of development, not collective. And so emotions are really only relevant in a interpersonal context. So it's easy to ignore them. And this is where the workaholic kind of shows up, right? The person who ignores their health and their feelings and their relationships to achieve their goals. Now, once you move to postmodern, all of a sudden interiority is important. All of a sudden, if you're going to meet somebody and have a relationship, you want to know who they are as an individual. And what's the best question to ask someone when you want to know about their interior experiences? It's like, how do you feel about that? You've just read Shakespeare. How do you feel about that? You just saw The Matrix. How do you feel about that? So it's really only in postmodernity that feelings have a role. And you can see that in the last 30 years, the emotional intelligence has emerged. But we still, as a culture, haven't differentiated emotions from feelings. And I have come to believe that you can't have a functional postmodernity until you've explicitly integrated some system of emotions and feelings into your system, so that all the complexity of all the interpersonal relationships that you're going through can be expressed adequately. In a sense, the challenges of traditional, which is where I grew up with, the challenges of there was we repressed the emotional system and it didn't really develop and it came back to haunt us all the time. In postmodernity, we're raising kids with open emotional systems, but we're not giving them the tools and the conceptual resolution to express and resolve them. And I sort of think that that might be why we have so much suicidal ideation, why we have so much ADHD type things, because their emotional systems are up and running and not contained and resolved and channeled through appropriate means. So we're kind of moving out of, well, in the past, I think people self-medicated with alcohol and drugs to keep the repression down. And now I think they're moving into depression and alcohol and drugs because they're overwhelmed with their feelings. And I think that's why we also have these new things with the attention deficit disorder stuff going on, because the emotional system's open, but it doesn't know how to resolve all of that energy, and it's just dissipating out in weird ways.
Yeah. And so if we give the postmodern self tools, like the one we talked about earlier on in our conversation, these releasing yes. statements or releasing practice, then what do we expect to happen then?
Well, so this, I guess, comes to another thing. When I've been trying to understand some of the dynamics of, say, the social justice warriors, or some of the difficulties that people are having in the workplace, when, you know, the radio comes on and, say, Jordan Peterson comes up as a topic and three people go, oh, that guy shouldn't get any airtime, you know, blah, 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 blah. And there's this huge emotional reaction. And the people who are actually like Jordan Peterson or have been benefiting aren't allowed to say anything, right? There's no room for an actual intellectual discourse. And what I've come to see is that I think what's going on is, because the emotional system's open and we're feeling things deeply, but we don't have the tools to differentiate, we're confusing the two realms of feeling something and thinking something, and they're not separated. So it's like, if I hear something and I feel really badly about it, the inference is, therefore, it must be bad. And that comes into my discourse. And I think when you start naming the feelings, you'll separate the emotional energy from the thinking process, and they'll be able to be worked with separately, so that you can actually say, okay, well, I feel really activated by Jordan. He seems like a really angry, you know, cisgendered white male, and that's triggering me. Now, once you start saying that and you take the charge away, now you're going to be able to actually look at what he's saying and have a rational discourse about the contents as opposed to the emotional and feeling reactions you're having with him. And you can't do that without a language to separate your feelings out to the level that you need in order to resolve them.
Yes. Yeah. And what also becomes available then is stepping into the next level of development, which I think typically in spiral dynamics, or I've heard you describe as integral or sometimes tier two. Could you talk a little bit about the role of these processes in helping us actually fully step into that developmental level? And just describe what that looks like a little bit.
Okay, in the world according to Doug here, in EBIC Integral, I see stage two a little differently than a lot of the other theorists in spiral dynamics do. And I don't think it's because we're divergent in our thinking. I've just been emphasizing the clinical component of it. And I haven't had the time to read and integrate it with the other theories. And I think it will actually map on well to teal and turquoise. But in my own clinical experience working with people, because I get to have the pleasure of watching people move to sometimes three stages of development in terms of where they're going to be center of gravity. I've come to see, to me, the definition of integral thinking. When Ken Wilber first started putting his work out, people believed that because they knew his integral theory, they were now integral. And that to me, not true. And I think we saw a lot of evidence of that, you know, as the group tried to interact with each other.
Yeah.
You can be very modern, which is just rational, and hear his rational ideas and, you know, get the benefit of his integral ideas without necessarily being able to think integrally. Mm-hmm. And what I've come to define as integral is when you move from a rational, linear, sequential way of thinking, which is a good way of thinking. That's how logic works. But you start doing pattern recognition. I actually believe it's because the emotional brain is kind of made to see patterns. That when you begin integrating the emotional brain and the intellectual brain, and they start working as a single unit, that the pattern recognition capacities of the emotional brain now start taking the conceptual objects of the intellect as something to find patterns in. And I think that's why Ken Wilber and most great insights, most, you know, mystics and people who have had great revelations have been in isolation, saturating themselves with a particular material. And the isolation part was that their emotional brain was no longer processing the external world and bouncing around with external dynamics of having to see, am I feeling dismissed or rejected? It could put all of its attentional resources on the interior world and see the patterns of the intellect and see and have a great insight. So when Ken Wilber, you know, came up with the four quadrants, I think that was part of the time when he was alone for 3 years without any interpersonal stimulation to separate his brains out from each other, because it was probably not a deep fusion yet. They hadn't really deeply integrated yet. So it's hard to do that if external stimulation is going to pull you out of that mindset. So as the emotional and physical brains start working together, the pattern recognition capacities start working on your concepts, and you start seeing patterns in your life. In the first stage, it's a deconstructive process. It's your individual ego structure that you've used for the first six stages, or that's developed over the first six stages, will begin to deconstruct. You'll start and see the way that you're doing it and that I work with people is you're starting to see all of the instances of your life where your feeling of inadequacy is showing up. In a sense, that's a pattern recognition. You can often, when you get the right feeling, belief, and you say it out loud, you'll actually feel 5 or 10 memories of significant times in your life get activated, and they'll all be there because you're literally seeing that you've been playing the same dance out since you were 5 years old. But when you've got the feeling belief and you're actually processing, you can actually feel them all healing at the same time. And you realize that you're not that sense of worthlessness that you've been believing all this time. Like, I am worthless and no one will ever love me. You see how that's played out. You no longer believe it, but you've done the pattern recognition to pull it out of your psyche, and it dissolves away. Mm. So you continue this pattern recognition based on core feeling impressions, and that'll probably do 90% or more of the work you need to really experientially differentiate yourself from all your past feeling history. And now, who are you without all of those ego structures and dynamics that you've been playing out all your life? Right? You're in a very, very different place. And if you continue doing that deconstructive work and you have a deep enlightenment experience, which is sort of like the ultimate deconstruction of yourself, I mean, that leads us to a very deep existential angst, especially if you haven't been given some sort of vision or doctrine to make sense of it. And I think I've mentioned this to you, that I see this as something that we do as a deep disservice to our spiritual community, as we take them through these deconstructive processes without having a forum or a place for them to reconstruct themselves, to have a vision of the world that will make sense of this, you know, apparent nihilistic attitude towards yourself, right? So we're left with literally the second stage is to take that deconstructed self and your deep insight into the nature of reality. And, you know, that's where deep history comes in, and you know, the large perspective of life moving through the cosmos over a million year period. Like, that's kind of where I've gone with this. And it's like, how do I make sense of my individualness in this huge scientific understanding of the meaninglessness of my life, or the, you know, the meaninglessness of my life in the process of, you know, some of the Buddhist constructs and things, if you don't really get Buddhism properly. And so the second stage is to find a vision that enlivens you, that integrates all of what you know and have come to understand at those deep levels, and still gives you a vision of meaning and purpose that gets you out of bed in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. I'm reflecting on my own journey with this. And I remember, you know, the first time I left the monastery, I was in a state of incredible meaninglessness and kind of nihilism and a sense of despair and feeling lost. And I talked to you out of that, and you mentioned this perspective of, you know, maybe I need a vision. Maybe I need to find some kind of vision that is motivating, that does get me out of bed in the morning. And now, like, looking back on the past couple of years, I think to a large degree, that's what this podcast has been for me, is trying to discover, like, how to be in relationship to the world in a way that makes sense and that's motivating and that actually, like, brings my heart to life and brings my life to life. And so, you know, I very much feel that what you just said mirrored in my own path with regards to these things.
Well, that's beautiful. And I just, you know, want to say how much I have appreciated what you've done with the Emerge podcast, because I listen to them and I gain a lot from listening to the different people that you interview. And I can just imagine the number of other people that are also listening to, you know, you're trying to find your place in the universe. And I think you've done a wonderful job, you know, so thank you so much for going through that struggle.
Thank you, Doug. Yeah, and your work has played a big part in it. I would like, if you have the time, there are two questions that or topics I'd just like to hear you speak on, and we can be brief if we need to. But the first is we talked at pretty good length about this daily emotional debris clearing, and I think it was really useful what we said. But we didn't really talk very much about the kind of deeper patterns of trauma and things like that. What is the relationship between this daily practice of emotional clearing and accessing this kind of like deeper gunk, this deeper material that might be kind of hiding beneath the surface?
Right. What you'll find is if, as you take up the practice of at the end of the day saying, okay, what am I activated by here? Where am I going back to? Sitting down, finding the core feelings. Inevitably, by the time you've done that for 4 or 5 or 10 days, you're going to notice that you keep going back to 2 or 3 core feelings. It just tends to be the way we are wired. It's when somebody comes in and they have like 7 out of 9 core feelings high, that's a really rough sign. That means they're really deeply traumatized and all of their sense of self and their traumas are kind of merged together. But most people will have 2 or 3 core feelings that they have to work with. So by the time you've spent the week doing this, you're going to start noticing that, which means that you're starting to see that there are patterns. Now, once you find the core feeling that shows up often, you'll notice if you spend time with it, the next stage emerges. And this is literally what happened as I worked with people, is that I found that these core feelings that we've been carrying around with us, they distort our perception of reality. So if, for example, I'm someone who feels worthless, and I'm talking to someone, and in the process of their communicating, say they've got, I've got my hands in front of me about a foot apart. They've got this much emotional charge on the communication, and a small portion, and I've now got my fingers about an inch apart, is where they're not really caring about me and how this is landing on me. But it's only like an inch of that foot. So there is a sense of not caring about me, but the other 90% is actually fairly sensitive to me. But I've noticed that one piece of their communication. Well, I'm going to take that one piece and I'm going to distort it up to 11 inches of they don't care about me and I am worthless. And the way that that distortion happens can actually be articulated in what I call a feeling belief. So it might be that, you know, one person's feeling belief generalization on worthlessness is, I am worthless and no one will ever respect me. And that's what they keep playing out. Another person's distortion of worthlessness is, I am worthless and no one will ever love me. And there's all sorts of variations that we can have on how we generalized our early experience about our self and our relationship to the world. So by finding that next level, what is your generalization? So for you, what's your generalization about aloneness? What's your generalization about inadequacy? And if you can go to the instances and find a phrase that actually brings more clarity and depth to your understanding of that dynamic, you're going to now really find, in a sense, a, how you've integrated that feeling impression into your sense of self. So in other words, the daily instances that we're experiencing of worthlessness, if we can find that feeling and find the generalization that we made long, long ago, we can now become free of that dynamic, right? That the one that we're playing out, the reason that we, I'll work with women who have, you say, a sense of worthlessness. And once we find that, you know, I am worthless and no one will ever love me, and they've worked that out of their system, I've actually had them, most all of them will say, you know, I realize this guy that I met it just out of high school that we dated twice and I got rid of, it was because he was treating me too well. And I literally believed I was worthless and no one would ever love me. So I couldn't believe he was being honest. I couldn't accept that. But now when they meet someone who treats them that well, they'll actually embrace it because they're no longer playing out that dynamic with the person because they've brought it into consciousness and cleared it out of their system.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And then the very, I appreciate you being so generous with your time, Doug. The very last thing I wanted to get your thoughts on is something we talked about before we like offline. I've been seeing a lot of chatter in my networks around this idea that's pretty radical that about the constructed nature of emotions, right? There's this idea that emotions are basically just concepts that we create and apply to aggregates of experience in kind of some way like that. And I what you have revealed to me seems to fly very much in the face of that. And I'm curious what your take on this idea that emotions are sort of more or less wholly constructed would be.
It's so antithetical to how I see the world. It's hard to comment about it other than I'd be happy to see which of our two frameworks last or here in 10 years. You can see there is a constructive component to what I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. We get in our feeling impressions and then we distort the world and construct our own realities based on them. But we seem to be aligned with certain principles and biological realities. So it is true that if you get someone angry, they have a physiological dance of chemicals that just happens. It can be really big and extreme, or it can be small and just a small portion of it is being elicited. But we seem to be genetically programmed to have those physiological components. Now, the differences in how we express anger and how we express fear, well, so much of that has to do with our coping capacities and personality styles that might be what she's confusing. Mm. It is a woman who wrote the book, is it not?
Yeah, the book in question, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's where she's saying all the constructive component is, but I would tend to see that as an underlying reality that's being distorted by different processes, coping and personality type things. I've got a lot of Buddhist training and I've spent a lot of my life deconstructing, you know, reality and the nature of myself and things. But I just can't see emotions deconstructing any further than I've done them, separating feelings and interpersonal feelings from core feelings, separating those from emotions. They don't seem to deconstruct any further than that. And you can put together most of the dynamics of our culture with those components. Mm. So that's sort of, unless I actually read the book and wrote a critique of it, which when I listened to it, I wasn't inclined to do that because I didn't think it would get any traction. Yeah. And maybe it's just a sign of how important it is for us as a culture to find a better way of understanding our emotions, that everyone's willing to take anything and see where it leads them. Mm. Mm. You know, and I think that's a good sign. And hopefully as people, you know, listen to what's being said in that book, they'll be able to validate for themselves whether what is being said is true or not. And if it's not true, they discard it. And if it's true, they keep to it. That's what I would hope anyone would do with my system as well.
Doug, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak about all this. I think it's been tremendously helpful in my own life, and I can only imagine that it's going to help a lot of listeners. And I'm curious, as we head towards the end of this conversation, if there's anything that you'd like to share before we close down the conversation.
Well, one of the things that'll happen is people are going to say, oh, can I find out more about this? And unfortunately, I don't have these books written yet. So, you know, what I've said today is kind of all there is to access other than like the paper that I presented at EBIC Integral, which I think is online there anymore because they stopped posting that theory conference from 2010. But I do have the paper on my website. I also think it might be good to mention that that I'll be doing a workshop at the Monastic Academy that you're at.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna be down at the Monastic Academy. They're asking me to do a workshop there. I think on June 21st to the 24th or 23rd. So that'll be an opportunity if people want to come and work with this. It's probably going to be very much in a meditative capacity. And there's actually two other techniques that I use to help with meditation and clearing processes. One of them for postural and pain type things. And then the other one is nadira noting, not just nadira clearing. So there's going to be some good stuff there, and it's going to be really practical.